Okay, everyone. Well, good afternoon. Welcome to the review of the Biostat 621 final exam. So I think that what we'll plan to do today is review each question, you know, question by question. This is certainly an opportunity. If you have any questions at all, we'll, raise your hand and we'll address those questions. And otherwise, we'll just keep going through until we've reached the end of the 20th question. Okay, so I do have the formula sheets available here, and we'll be referring to them a bit. But these first three questions concern general knowledge, and so let's look at each of these in turn. So the first one says, the sampling distribution of the sample mean has, and it says, circle only one response. So first of all, I think we could underline, you know, that it's asking for the sampling distribution of the sample mean. We know that's the sample mean X bar. So if we think the sampling distribution under certain situations will be approximately normal, and we talk about the sampling distribution of X bar, we talk about it being characterized by a mean, mu of X bar, and a standard deviation, sigma of X bar. So if I was looking at this, I might think that sigma of X bar is sigma over the square root of n. But if I wanted to use the formula sheet to try to remind myself, I'd probably go to the formula sheet on the first page where it talked about one sample so that I could identify that X bar was the sample statistic here and recognize that the standard error or the standard deviation of X bar is what's in the denominator. So sigma of X bar is sigma over the square root of n. So just to remind myself of what that is. So if we see the word variance here, we know that the variance is just the square of the standard deviation. So the variance, sigma squared of X bar, is sigma squared over n. So we could go through each of these responses as either true or false. So the sampling distribution of the sample mean has A, increased variance as the number of repeated samples taken increases. So what's the problem with both A and B that are talking about the number of repeated samples? So it says repeated samples, the number of repeated samples taken. So in fact, this sampling distribution of X bar is talking about all possible samples, right? So it's not a set number, it's all possible samples in theory of size n. So we wouldn't be looking at A or B, because the variability of the sampling distribution doesn't depend on the number of repeated samples, because we're looking at just whatever all possible samples are. It's dependent on two things: sigma, the spread or the variability in the population, as well as the sample size n. So C says increased variance with increasing sample size, but because the sample size n is in the denominator, the spread is decreased with increasing sample size. So C is false. The next one says decreased variance with increasing sample size. That's true. So the answer here was D, decreased variance with increasing sample size. And the last one says increased variance with decreased variability in population measurements. So what that would be saying is that if sigma or sigma squared was decreased, then the numerator would be less, and there would be decreased variability in the sampling distribution. So this is also false. It wouldn't be increased, it would be decreased. So that was number one. So if there's no questions about that, we'll go to number two. So number two is saying, if the sample size is approximately 25 or larger, so if little n is greater than or equal to 25, the central limit theorem says what? And so it's asking for what the central limit theorem would say. We'll go through each of these as true and false as well. So A is the population distribution of measurements is approximately normal. So if we had systolic blood pressure measurements that are right skewed, the central limit theorem doesn't change this distribution. So all that the central limit theorem says is that the distribution of the sample statistic The mean systolic blood pressure, X bar, is what would be approximately normal. So A is false because the central limit theorem does not change the population distribution. B says the sample distribution of measurements is approximately normal. If we were to take a sample of size 25 from a population, we would expect that the sample distribution would also look skewed if it was skewed. So that is also false. C, the distribution of sample means from all possible samples of the same size, so all possible samples of the same size, little n, is approximately normal. So that is what the central limit theorem tells us. The underlying distribution of X bar is approximately normal with a given mean, which is equal to the population mean mu, and a standard deviation equal to sigma over the square root of n. And then the last two, D says the distribution of sample variances from all possible samples of the given sample size is approximately normal. You would say, what? We haven't been talking about distribution of variances, so that is false. And then it says the sample distribution can be approximated by a t-distribution, so that's just mixing up sample distribution and what we use the t for, which is we use a t instead of a z when sigma, the population variance, is unknown. So E does not have anything to do with the central limit theorem. Okay, so far so good. On to question three. So question three says, which of the following identifies a data type whose distribution reasonably could be described by a Poisson distribution, but not a binomial distribution? So we have five different replies. Response A is, in a random sample of five older women, the number of them who experienced an injurious fall during a calendar year. So the injurious fall will be a dichotomous outcome, yes or no, and we're looking out of a sample of n equals five women, how many of them experienced that event. So since it's dichotomous, we have these five older women, can it be described by a binomial distribution? Yes. So since it's described by a binomial, one might ask, could it also be described by a Poisson? It could, but the sample size here is pretty small. But we're looking for a data type that's described by a Poisson but not a binomial. So since this can be described by a binomial, the first response is false. The next response, B, says in a random sample of 100 older women, so here n is equal to 100, the number of them who experienced an injurious fall during a calendar year. So again, dichotomous event, 100 women, could this be described by a binomial? Yes. Could it be approximated by a Poisson? Yes. But this is asking for Poisson but not binomial. So this would also be false because it can be described by a binomial. So this one was a little bit tricky because it was said not binomial, right? But both A and B can be described by a binomial. In the next one, C, it says, in a random sample of two pairs of older sisters, the number of them who experienced an injurious fall during a calendar year. So here the key was that it said two pairs of older sisters. So in terms of assumptions that we make, can this be described by a Poisson distribution? Can it be described by a binomial? So it's not independent, they're paired relationships, paired observations, so we wouldn't be able to describe this by either Poisson, so not Poisson, not binomial. So because of that, this one is also false, because we're looking for what can be described by Poisson, but not binomial. So we've made it through the third one, and then the last two, D says for one older woman, the number of injurious falls she experiences during a calendar year, And let's look at E as well. For one older woman, the time that passes between midnight on January 1st and the first injurious fall in a given calendar year. So maybe let's look at E first. So when we're talking about elapsed time between January 1st to a particular date in the calendar, is this a dichotomous outcome? It's continuous, right? So this would be a continuous outcome, not dichotomous. So this wouldn't be described by either. So it's not a binomial. It's not described by a Poisson either, because it's a continuous variable. And so all that we've seen so far that allows us to describe a continuous variable is the normal distribution. So neither the Poisson nor the binomial would be appropriate there. So E is false. But let's look back at, for one older woman, the number of injurious falls she experiences during a calendar year. So we said the Poisson was appropriate when we had dichotomous outcomes, rare events, and we also said that this could be something that we're modeling with respect to either time or space. And so we're making an assumption that the probability of having an injurious injury, so a fall that results in injury for a woman over calendar time, is going to be rare, that the probability of occurring in any one small interval of time is close to zero. But the best response to this question was D. So we're allowing it to be within the same woman, but we're looking at assuming that this probability of occurring multiple times is very, very low. Okay, so a lot of this was ruling this out by the fact that the first three could not be described by a binomial or a Poisson, the last one could be neither, and that the one that we're looking at, number of dichotomous injuries, so number of injuries during a calendar year, is on the same woman, but it's in repeated measures, assuming that there's not a high correlation in the probability of having them in any small, repeated in any small interval, is very low. Okay. So questions on that? Were there ones that you answered instead of that one? So what did you answer? You answered the other one? You mean the one that talked about the time that passed? Okay, so let's rule that out. So if you answered yes for the time that passes between midnight on January 1st and her first fall that results in an injury in a given calendar year, we're talking about elapsed time. So how could that be measured? This time that passes could be measured in hours or days, right, or months. So this is going to be a continuous variable. It's not going to allow us to model it as a dichotomous outcome. If we talked about, if this could be Poisson, what would your lambda have been in that response? What would lambda be, the expected number of events? No, so you don't have, so lambda is the expected number of events, but if you have a continuous time period that's measured in hours or days or months, you don't have an expected number of events. You might be able to get the mean number of hours or the mean number of days, and that might be described by a normal distribution or some other continuous distribution. So the problem with that other one is that this is looking at the outcome as being continuous. So a continuous outcome measured in some element of time. Yeah. So for that other one, although it's the same woman, that we're allowing this to be repeated episodes potentially that are rare within the same woman. So we're really making an assumption that one is not influencing the next, right? It's a rare event, and it's modeling it either within, you know, time or space. So we said some examples were looking at stars in a galaxy, or, you know, admissions into an emergency room, you know, or something that allows us to model rare events that are dichotomous, yes or no, And it can occur within the same woman, but we would be, you know, under the assumption that they're independent. Okay, yeah. Right. Right. So the comment that's being made is that, you know, maybe this assumption cannot be necessarily justified because of the fact that if it's an older woman, and the key word is older, and if they are prone to a fall, then, you know, it could be that if once they fall, they are prone to fall again unless there are certain measures that are taken, you know, to watch out for them. So I would, you know, agree with you. I think that what we could see is that if everybody agrees, the first three are wrong because we know that A and B could be described by binomial distribution. The one that talks about the two pairs of older sisters, so there's definitely a correlation between them, would also not be able to be modeled by a Poisson or a binomial. And then this last one, I'm hoping it makes sense that this elapsed time is a continuous variable and not a dichotomous. So if one could say, which is the best out of these possible five, we would go with this one. You know, is it always necessarily true? Maybe not. Maybe not. So points well taken. Okay, we'll go on to a scenario then. So we have some questions that are all regarding data from a study to investigate maternal postpartum depression. So this is within 1 year after childbirth as a risk factor for some outcomes of family homelessness at 3 years of follow-up. And so this is taken from a table that shows two groups, women with postpartum depression in the first year after birth and those without, and then they're totaled in the last column. And then there are some baseline characteristics that are given here, and then there are 2 3-year outcomes given at the bottom of the table. So let's just orient ourselves a bit here because this is exactly how the table was presented in the journal. If you looked at it, it would say that there's an N, which is the sample size in both of these groups and the total, that years of age was given as a mean and a standard deviation. So for us, we know that this means X bar and S from the sample. We have some percentages here that would have to total to 100, or else the percentage who are yes, that have a particular characteristic like prenatal physical health condition or a prenatal diagnosis of mental illness. Those are the percent yes. Then we go down to the CESD depression score, which again has a mean and a standard deviation, X bar and S. And then this little asterisk was just to refer to the fact that of all of those, just as it says, the data are either shown as the mean and the standard deviation for a continuous covariate or as column percentages for the categorical covariates. Okay, so I put a little excerpt of Table 1 here for us to look at along with the question. So it says, looking at Table 1, which of the following baseline factors appears to be the most highly associated with, so in parenthesis, not independent of. So what is not independent of? It's the same as saying dependent. If it's not independent, it means that this characteristic is dependent on postpartum depression or conversely. So what it's asking us to do is to look at whether these two characteristics are similar in both groups. So if they were similar in both groups, it means there's no association. If they're different in both groups, it means there is an association. So let's just go through each of them. So age, we're comparing women with versus without postpartum depression. Age is showing about a mean age of 25 with a standard deviation of about 6 in both groups. So association or no association? No association. If we look at ethnicity, we look at these percentages. In each group, about 20% are non-Hispanic whites, about 50% are non-Hispanic blacks, About 26% or so are Hispanic and 3 to 4% are other, similar or different? Similar. Associated, not associated? Not associated, because they're similar in both groups. So postpartum depression does not depend on ethnicity. Prenatal physical health condition, about 20% in both groups, so not associated. And lastly, prenatal diagnosis of mental illness, 22% of those in the postpartum group had a prenatal diagnosis of mental illness, compared to 10% in the non-depressed group. So twice as high a percentage, which would suggest association. And we could look at one more, CESD. The mean is pretty much the same in both groups, so no association. So I'd bet on prenatal diagnosis of mental health. So this is the one that appears the most highly associated with, because they're different. They're different. Okay, so then the next one was number 5. So if a woman was randomly selected from this study population, what's the probability that she would have postpartum depression or a prenatal diagnosis of mental illness? And so when it says if a woman was selected from this study population, we're talking about selecting her from the total of 2,974. Does that make sense? And if I wrote this as a probability statement, I'd say, what's the probability that she has postpartum depression or she has prenatal diagnosis of mental illness? And if I think back to the, or look at the formula sheet for the addition rule, probability of one or the other will be the probability of postpartum depression plus the probability of having a diagnosis of mental illness, plus, and what else? Minus the probability that they have both characteristics, postpartum depression and prenatal diagnosis of mental illness. Okay, so now our task is to figure out, and you may have done this in different ways, figured out how to calculate this probability. So if we were to use this probability statement, looking at the union of the two, then we could do it that way, and you could also let me know if you had some other way of doing this as well. So should we start off with this? Look at the probability of having postpartum depression. That's the first part. So what's the probability of postpartum depression? That would be, what's the chance out of this group that they have postpartum depression? Right, so the first part will be 375 over 2974. Okay, that's the probability of postpartum depression. That's the first part. So we can add, what's the probability of having a pre-diagnosis of mental illness? So this is actually saying this is 11% of the 2974. So if we wanted to look at this as a probability, we know that this is just 0.11. If we wanted, so this is 11%, 0.11. But I might make you feel better if we had the same denominator for each of them. Tell me if you want the same denominator. If you do, then we would take 0.11 times 2974, and we would have seen that 11% of this would be 327 women out of 2974. Are you all with me? So 11%. So we've done now, we've added in the second term, but now we need to subtract the probability that they have postpartum depression and a pre-diagnosis illness condition. And so now, what is that cell? This would be the group that we're seeing here in the lower left side. Whoops, sorry. That is saying out of those with postpartum depression, 22% have prenatal diagnosis of mental illness. So the question is, out of the total group, how many is this? So if we took 22% of 375, are you still with me? So 22% of 375 would give us a number out of the total that reflects the number who have both characteristics, have postpartum depression and a pre-diagnosis illness, prenatal diagnosis of mental illness. So 0.22 times 375 is what? If we go through this, I'm going to just cross this through and say this is about 82.5 individuals, maybe rounded up to 83 out of 2974. Are you all with me on this last step? Okay, so now we have three probabilities. We're adding the first two and subtracting the third, but they all have the same denominator of 2,974. So it looks like what we can do now is add 375 plus 327 and then subtract 83 or so. So 375 plus 327 minus 83. I'm getting about 619. So 619 out of 2,974 would be about 0.21. Okay, so that's just one way you could have done this. Some of you may have thought through this in different ways. Did you? Or did you go through it in this way? Okay, well, this way works, right? Because it's using the addition rule. It's taking the probability of those two characteristics minus their joint probability. We get about 0.21. Okay, then the next question, number six, says suppose that five women are randomly selected from the group of women with postpartum depression. So we know n equals five. I'm looking at just the row that is showing those with prepartum depression and postpartum and those without. And then the total is the last. But we see here the percentages who had prenatal diagnosis of mental illness. So we're just looking at the group that had postpartum depression. So we're looking at here the probability of postpartum depression would have to be 0.22 based on the table. And now we're asked, with those five, what's the probability that the first two and at least two of the remaining three have a prenatal diagnosis of mental illness. So that means the first two, so what's the probability that the first two, so I'm going to write this as a probability statement, the first two and at least, meaning greater than or equal to two of the last three, have a prenatal diagnosis of mental illness. So what is kicking in here is independence. So what's the probability that the first one has a prenatal diagnosis? It's 0.22. And what's the probability that the second one does? 0.22. And I can just multiply these because this is the probability that the first has the diagnosis and the second has the diagnosis. So far so good on this? Or do you want me to write it another way? Right, I can say that one more time. So what I really could expand this to say is it's the probability that the first has a diagnosis, prenatal diagnosis, and the second has a prenatal diagnosis, and greater than or equal to two out of the last three, which allows me to say it's the probability that the first one has a prenatal diagnosis times the probability that the second has a prenatal diagnosis times the probability that the number out of three is X is greater than or equal to 2. So since these five individuals are all assumed to be independent, I know that the probability that the first has a prenatal diagnosis of mental illness is 0.22. So I multiply 0.22 times the probability that the second does. I multiply by also 0.22. Then I'm left with what's the probability that at least two, meaning two out of three of the remaining, have that diagnosis. So here's a strict binomial probability based on the probability that X is equal to 2 plus the probability that X equals 3. Because we know the probability that X is greater than or equal to 2, since there's only 3 remaining women, has to be the probability that X equals 2 plus the probability that X equals 3. So we have 0.22 multiplied by itself for the first two women, so that's 0.22 squared. And now we just have to say, what's our P? Our P is 0.22. What's our Q? It's 1 minus that, which is 0.78. So we have the P and the Q. We know that the number that we're dealing with is the remaining 3. So we can write the probability that X equals 2 as 3 choose 2, P, which is 0.22 raised to the second power times 0.78, so 0.22 to the second times 0.78. I'm running out of space here, but it's there. It's really there. So let's just write it a little bit cleaner. Probability that X equals 2 is 3 choose 2 times 0.22 to the second power times 0.78. The probability that X equals 3 is 3 choose 3 times 0.22 to the third power times 0.78 to the zero. So what we can see is that this is looking very much like what we see for A. So we have 0.22 squared times what we have labeled as the probability that X equals 2 plus the probability that X equals 3, just plugging in the binomial formula. Okay. It would have been a different question if we had asked, what's the probability that at least 2 of the 5 had a prenatal diagnosis of mental illness, because we would have just looked at what's the probability that X equals 2 or 3 or 4 or 5. But this one was fixing the first two as both having prenatal diagnosis of mental illness, and then it's asking of the remaining 3, what's the probability that at least 2 also had a prenatal diagnosis of mental illness. Okay. Moving on. Or other questions on this? This is the time to ask a question. So if you have a question, please feel free. Okay. Or afterwards. So number 7 says, assuming a normal distribution for age, what proportion in the group of women with depression in the postpartum year, so this is meaning out of this group with postpartum depression, would be expected to be age 34 years or older? So this is not asking anything about the mean age. It's talking about assuming a normal distribution for age. So I could give a normal curve here in which the random variable X is equal to age. And so now we have to say, how are we going to figure out what proportion, meaning what's the probability that the person would be age 34 years or older? So we're looking in this right tail, 34 or older, but we'd have to say, how do we figure this out? We have to have some estimate of the mean and some estimate of the standard deviation if we assume this to be normally distributed. So all that we're given are some sample statistics. So we have X bar, which is 24.4, and we have S, which is 5.8 years. But if we're assuming age is normally distributed, what's our best estimate of sigma and our best estimate of mu? It's really all that we have. This is all we have, is what we're given in the data. So our point estimate is saying our best guess at mu, so I'll call it mu hat, is 24.4. Our best estimate at sigma is S, which is 5.8. So we're basically asking, what's the probability that X is greater than 34 to get that area in the right tail? And so to transform to a Z, on both sides, we're taking X minus mu divided by sigma. So that's on the left side. I could now write that as approximately a Z. So I'm going to put hats over mu and sigma because they're my best guesses at the true mean and standard deviation. But on the right-hand side, I'll have 34 minus 24.4 divided by 5.8. And this is all because what's the random variable? The random variable is x. It's not x bar. So we're not taking sigma divided by the square root of n. We're trying to figure out what proportion of the total women in that postpartum depressed group would be older than 34. What fraction of them? So if you go through a little bit of math, what do you end up getting? So we'll take 34.4 divided by 20 minus 24.4 divided by 5.8. That Z is about greater than 1.66. So we'd have to look up the Z in the right tail and the P in the B column of the Z tables. It's one-tailed. That's right. So why is it one-tailed? Let's think about it. It's just saying, out of this total group of women with different, you know, ages in this group, what fraction is older than 34? So it's not, so just in the right-hand tail. It's not asking what, you know, or more extreme in the other direction. It's not asking language like that. It's just saying what proportion, what fraction is older than 34? So it's one tail. We look at 1.66. I think if you look that up, that's it's about 0.05. So about 0.05. So we would look with B as the appropriate response. Yes. That's right. So that's good you asked this question, because I'd like to have some conversation about that. So we didn't take sigma, or our estimate of sigma, divided by the square root of n. And that was because, what's our random variable? The random variable is x. It's not x bar. So I'll take you back to the formula sheet just for a moment to look at the formula sheet. If our random variable is x, then what we're doing when we rescale this to a z is we subtract the mean, we divide by the standard deviation. If our random variable is a statistic like x bar, we're dividing by the standard error that's associated with that statistic. So we could have changed this question. Should we think of a different exam question? The different exam question would have been, so anybody want to think of what it would be? To have a different standard error? Right, it would have been about mean age. So it would have said, if this study had been repeated with the same sample size by, you know, a number of different investigators, the different question that we're not asking would have been, what's the probability that the sample mean would have been greater than 34? And if the question had been about the sample mean in the new study being greater than 34, then we would have transformed to a Z by taking X bar minus the mean divided by sigma over the square root of n, because that's the standard error of x bar. And then we would have taken 34 minus 24.4 over 5.8 over the square root of the sample size. So a different question. Naira. Yes. Great question. So the question is, when you're reading a journal article, you know, and you see the data like this, even though this is a pretty large sample size, 2,974, you know, total, this is still, you would consider anything you read to be a study, that it's a sample. So even if it's large, even if the sample is based on, you know, a study that's done that has 34,000, you know, women in it, it's still a sample. Because it's meant to then, the results of that study are giving you an inference about the broader population of individuals. So this is trying to refer to the broader population of individuals who have postpartum depression or don't. Right, so when you're doing your own study, and let's pretend this was our study, you know, it's good enough to be our study, so we would ask a question like we're going to be asking, which is, is there a statistically significant difference in the thing that we're going to be looking at are these proportions of homeless or at risk of homelessness. So is there a statistically significant difference? Our eyeball says the sample proportion is 6% in the postpartum depressed group versus 2%, but those aren't population proportions, they're sample proportions. And we're trying to make an inference about the broader population of women based on the observed 375 in the postpartum depressed group versus the 2599. So what we were doing in this exam question was taking you to think about if you use these sample statistics as estimates of the truth. So our best point estimate of mu, the true population mean, is X bar, 24.4 years. And our best estimate of the variability in the underlying population is based on our sample standard deviation of 5.8. So based on that information, if age itself, not X bar, not mean age, but if age was normally distributed, then we could answer a question of what proportion would be expected to be greater than 34, or what proportion would be expected to be less than some other age. So we transform that to a Z to get an estimate of the proportion in the underlying population that are age 34 or older. Okay. But I like the question about mean age, because it's saying, what's the chance that if you repeated the study, you'd get a mean age of 34 or greater? Okay. So then we'll go on to 8, which is actually a little bit associated with what we've just been discussing, because it asks, from the data in Table 1, the standard error of the mean CESD depression score. So key word here is mean depression score. So whenever we see that word mean depression score related to a study, we have lights going on that say X bar, right? Sample mean, X bar. So it's asking, what's the standard error of the mean for women with postpartum depression? So sigma of X bar is the standard error of the mean. Standard error of the mean. It's given by sigma over the square root of n. But if we don't know sigma, we're estimating this by what we'll call sigma hat, which is S. So we know when we're looking at that group of postpartum depressed women that X bar is 1.25, S is 1.1. And what was the sample size again? I didn't copy it down here. But it was 375 from the previous page, so N was 375. So we know the standard error of the mean is estimated as 1.1 over the square root of 375. And if you go through a little bit of math, how many points is that? So it's pretty small, because the square root of 375 is about 19, and then take the square root of that. So it is about 0.06 points. So it's important to keep in mind, maybe we'll talk about this, that S of 1.1 points reflects variability in the scores, the CESD scores themselves. So it's a measure of spread in the scores themselves, whereas the standard error of the mean of 0.06, which is much smaller, reflects what? So S over the square root of N reflects, so it reflects variability or spread in what? Here's the hint, in what? In the X bars, right? So it's reflecting the variability or spread in the possible sample means. So S reflects variability in the scores themselves. And so I would say the scores are the X's. Sigma X bar reflects variability or spread in the possible X bars. Okay, so we're always going to expect standard error of the mean to be much less than the standard deviation itself. Okay, keep going. Number nine. So a previous study found an average CESD depression score of 1 point in women with postpartum depression. If we hypothesize, so I'm going to set up a null hypothesis, that this study represents women with a postpartum depression sampled from a population with a mean CESD score of 1 point, what's the p-value associated with the corresponding two-sided test? So our null hypothesis is that mu is equal to 1 point, and a two-sided test says the alternative hypothesis is that mu is not equal to 1 point. And then we have to go back, and I have it here, in that postpartum group, what's the sample size? 375. Sample size is 375. What's S? 1.1. What's X bar? 1.25. Do we have everything that we need? Yes, we have everything that we need. So we know we have S, not sigma. We weren't told what sigma was. So if we set up a hypothesis test that the mean is some hypothesized value of 1, our test statistic is going to be a 0 or a T. T, why? We don't know sigma, so we use S and then a T. And we'll take X bar minus the hypothesized value, so I'll set it up, X bar minus mu naught all over S over the square root of N. And I'll just remind us that we don't have to memorize that, right? We can go to the formula page. And it was there. It was there. So it's just that what we're doing now is setting up T equals 1.25, which is X bar. The hypothesized value was 1. And the standard error is S, which is 1.1 over the square root of 325. So that's our observed T statistic, 375, sorry, thank you, 375. So we have the observed T statistic, and the p-value is going to be the probability of that that T is greater than 1.25 minus 1 over 1.1 divided by the square root of 3.375. And since it's two-sided, it would be just multiplied by 2. So we would expect to see that response somewhere here for number 8 or number 9. So what we can see is we have 1.25 minus 1 divided by 1.1 over the square root of 375. We see a number of different things. The Z's will rule out. Anything that has a Z will rule out because we don't know sigma. We know only the sample standard deviation. We have two that have T statistics. Is it the appropriate degrees of freedom? So N minus 1 is 374 as degrees of freedom. And so one of them is one-tailed. The other one is two-tailed. In fact, one of them is 1 minus. It's the cumulative probability to the left. So we're looking for the two-tailed probability, so we're looking for C, 2 times the probability that T is greater than what we see to the right. And then what's the matter with E? There's not, we don't have an observed X-bar statistic, but we also see that this isn't accounting for the sample size as well in the standard error. Okay, so we're left with this 2 times the probability of getting an observed T statistic greater than a certain magnitude. Yes? No, so let's dissect those sentences again. So this is saying that a previous study found this average depression score of 1. So that became our hypothesis. The next one says, if we hypothesize, so it is an assumption, but it is our hypothesis, our null hypothesis, that we've actually done a study that represents women from the population that that previous study was taken from. Sure. So to say it again, we're hypothesizing that that this current study was performed on the same population that the previous study was taken from. And because of that, we're hypothesizing that previous study came from a population. Let me say it again. Rewind. Shall I try this one more time? I'm going to rewind. It says, if we hypothesize that this study represents women with postpartum depression sampled from a population with a mean score of 1. So what that statement in English is saying, a previous study found a difference of 1. If we hypothesize that the current study was drawn from a population in which the mean CESD score was 1 point, that hence our null hypothesis that we are sampling from a population with a mean that happened to be found in the previously published study. We're trying to look at how likely is it that we would have observed a sample mean, right, of 1.25 if the true mean in the population from which we sampled was 1. So basically the first sentence is giving us some information that in a prior study we saw a CESD score of 1. Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know how other people thought about this question. It's really unclear.
Okay. Right. Okay, so I will take that as a good point in terms of grammatically this could have been fixed. So, you know, our problem is we try to beta test this, but we actually have a new exam every single time. New exam every 4 weeks. Forever. So I would change this. My English in me would now change this. Given that you're all sitting here with me, which is delightful, I would change this to say, a previous study found this. If we hypothesize that, and I wouldn't say this study actually, I probably would say that the current study, meaning the one in which we are basing this whole scenario, represents women with postpartum depression from a sample with a mean of 1 point, right? So I'm hypothesizing that the study that we've just done has come from a population that has a true mean CESD score of 1 point. That allows me to state the null hypothesis that mu is 1, that in the present, so I definitely would want to say the current study, because this study could have been the previous study in the first sentence, right? Or it could have been the current study, which we've been talking about, you know, with all these other questions. So I would say that a much better English, grammatically correct statement would be, if we hypothesize that the current study represents women from a population where the mean is 1, we'd set up the null hypothesis that mu is 1 versus the alternative that it's not 1. We'd have the sample statistics from table 1, and we'd go about doing this t-statistic. So the only justification that I would say, except for that fact that misplaced this could have been, you know, elucidated, is that our scenario is saying questions 4 through 13, you know, are going to pertain to the data from, you know, this table. Good point. So the clarification would be that, you know, we're exploring CESD depression score, you know, and postpartum, right? Postpartum depression, yes or no. And the previous study was looking at it. We have a current study that's looking at it, and we're trying to hypothesize something about the true population mean CESD score. Thank you. Good point. We'll try to be clearer with our this's. This was an unclear this. Yeah. On 8? Yes. Never.
Right. We're saying that that's our true
Yeah, so... Right. So you know what? I think that you would all have been much happier with a change I'm going to propose right now to this question. And that is that all that we were trying to do was support a justification for hypothesizing that the mean CESD score was 1. So a very simple fix could have been, forget that first line, right? It's our justification for assuming a mean of 1 was just that prior data suggested it was about that amount. But if we just started with saying, if we hypothesize that this study, then what study was this study? It was the study that we've been talking about since question 4. That's this study. So I think you're all being very, very good in this, but you know, this is a study, it's a sample. It's taken some from broader population. We make some hypothesis. How do we make a hypothesis? It's based on, what's it based on? What is any hypothesis based on? Prior knowledge, prior data, prior studies. It's easier when we have 2 group comparisons because often we're hypothesizing of no difference in means or no difference in proportions. But this was meant, this first sentence was just trying to justify why we would even talk about 1 point. But I think if you forgot that first sentence and if you just said, if we hypothesize that this, meaning the current study, represents women with postpartum depression sampled from an underlying population with a mean CESD score of 1 point, you'd probably have not felt that there was this unclearness. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. So the question was, what if the answer, which was C, 2 times the probability with a T of 374, what if this was a Z? So what is theoretically wrong with that? Theoretically, it will be a T because we don't know sigma. But, you know, we do know that as the sample size increases, the T becomes closer to the Z in value, but theoretically it is a T. Right, so I would say if the two are an option like that, you'd always go with the T. If Stata is doing this for you, it's doing an exact T. Right, and so option A looks similar, but it's not two-sided as well. It's only one-sided. Okay. So thank you for those. Those were important comments on the clarity of the question. We will take them under consideration in the future. What about number 10? So number 10 is a two-part question. So number 10 says, assume a normal distribution for the CESD depression scores in table 1. And we're interested in women with CESD scores of 180 or greater. So, first of all, 1.8, sorry, not 180, 1.8. So, first of all, we've been looking at those CESD scores quite a bit, so we've memorized the mean already. But we could go back and look. We know the mean is 1.25 and the standard deviation is 1.1. So the next part is saying, suppose a random sample of 50 was chosen from this group. What's the probability that the sample proportion of women with scores greater than 1.8, that sample proportion, meaning P hat, is 0.25 or higher? So the first step is to say, if we're assuming a normal distribution for those CESD scores, then the mean was 1.25. That's where we're assuming the mean to be. And the standard deviation was 1.1. And it's really asking what proportion are greater than 1.8 or greater. So we're saying, assuming a normal distribution in that first, and we're interested in the women who have a score of 1.8 or greater, so why don't we figure out that proportion? Can we do it? Can we? I think so, right? So what would we do to get, whoops, I got rid of the normal distribution. So 1.8 or greater when the X variable is CESD score. So aren't we still trying to get that right-hand tail? So the first step, I'm just going to call it step one, is to say, what's the probability that X is greater than 1.8? Are you happy with this so far? So we'll transform it to a Z. So to transform it to a Z, we're really subtracting mu, dividing by sigma, or the estimates of their of them. So 1.8 minus 1.25 over 1.1, which should be something like the probability of Z being greater than, have to go through the math. Anybody do that already? 0.5? Okay, 0.5. So we'd have to look this up. Did anybody look this up in the Z table? Do you want me to get the Z table, or is it okay to say look in column B? It was about 0.3085 if we actually take it out. Naira, do you have a question? No? So the question here is that we're going to get to the second step, which is with proportions for the Z. But here, we're actually saying we're not doing a hypothesis test. We're just trying to estimate what is the proportion of women who have a CESD score greater than 1.8. So think back what we have. We say, assume a normal distribution for CESD depression scores. We're interested in women whose scores are 1.80 or greater. And okay, so we'll get to the second half. Should we get to the second half? Okay, so our first step, right, the first step was just saying, what proportion is this? So it looks like it's about 0.31, right? Would you all agree with me? Okay, it looks like 0.31. So now let's go to the second step. The second step is now asking a question. If you took a random sample of 50 women from this group, what's the probability that the sample proportion, also known as P hat, what's the probability that P hat is going to be greater than 0.2, greater than or equal to 0.25? Yes? How is that so far? Is that what this sentence is asking? What's the probability that the sample proportion of women with CESD scores greater than 180 is 0.25 or higher? Greater than or equal to 0.25. Okay, so now here is where we have a sample proportion, and we will always transform proportion, sample proportions to Z's. So let's transform to a Z. So it's the probability that, so on the left-hand side, we'll change this to a Z. On the right-hand side, we have 0.25. We would subtract the so our P, the probability of being greater than 1.8, is equal to 0.3080, 3085. That we can consider, if you will, as our P-naught. And what's our Q-naught? It'll just be 1 minus that. So 0.6. Okay. So it's 5196. 0.6915. Those should add. Okay. So we have a P naught and a Q naught. So what we're doing is subtracting 0.3085 in the numerator, and we're dividing by 0.3085 times 0.6915 divided by the what? The sample size, which is 50. So we're dividing by that. So this is now, we've transformed our sample statistic P hat to a Z. And then we have to go through a little bit of math. Our little bit of math would say the probability of Z being greater than, so this is going to be negative in the numerator, so greater than negative 0.9. If you go through the math, And that probability, if you keep going, is going to be about 0.82. Okay, so let's step back and look at each of these steps again. So everybody was okay with saying, we're interested in the proportion of women who are 1.8 on the CESD score or greater, right? That's what we're saying in the first sentence. And we saw the probability of being greater than 1.8 on that score was about 0.3085 if we assumed a normal distribution. What do you think? Thumbs up on that? Mm-hmm. It is a difficult question. Okay. So there's two, you know, so it is trying to indicate that, you know, we're assuming this normal distribution. It is a two-part question. We're assuming the normal distribution, and so that allows us to calculate the probability of 1.8 or higher. Then it's saying, given the data that you've observed, what's the chance when you took samples of size 50, what's the chance of getting a sample proportion that's 0.25 or greater? Sarah? Right. Right.
Noticing that the self-eval problem in this term is very similar. So I guess that if they don't give you a proportion, you know, if a proportion isn't given, you have to, you know, get the probability to get the proportion. And then if they ask you to test it, then you have to go through.
Right. And so this was not a test as much as saying if you have a sampling distribution of sample proportions, p hats, from all possible samples of size 50, what's the chance that you would get a sample proportion of 0.25 or something greater based on the data that you've seen in this study, in which if we assumed a normal distribution of the CESD scores, the mean was 1.25, the standard deviation was 1.1, so the chance of getting into that normal distribution, 1.8 or more, was 0.3085. So we're not setting it up as a hypothesis test per se, but we're asking, out of all those possible p hats that came from studies of size 50, what's the chance, using the data we had from the table one, what's the chance that we would get 0.25 or something bigger? And that's what translated into what I'm calling step two. What's the probability that p hat would be greater than or equal to 0.25? Transform that to a z by subtracting this observed proportion of 0.3085 divided by the standard error, which is the square root of 0.3085 times 0.6915 over 50. And that translates into the probability of getting a z greater than negative 0.9. And that probability under the z would be the same as the probability of getting a sample proportion greater than 0.25, and that was about 0.82. So it was meant to be an integrative question of taking information from the first part and given in the table and then applying it to the question at hand, what's the probability of getting p hat sample proportion of women with scores greater than 1.8 of 0.25, p hat of 0.25 or greater.
It makes a lot more sense once you draw it.
It makes a lot more sense once you go through it. It maybe would have been easier, you would say, and I would agree with you. It could have been an easier question if it had just asked part one, right, or part two. But this was asking you to do part one to get to step two.
Yeah.
No, so I think the question was, is there some other way of doing this other than going to the normal tables? And there really isn't, because you need the normal table for the first part, to say, what's the chance under this normal assumption of getting 1.8 or bigger? You need the normal table to calculate the probability of p hat greater than 0.25. Okay, I wonder where you went, Naira. Can you tell me where you went directly from? Because it seems to me you have to get z greater than negative 0.9 in order to do that. Okay, well, why don't you look back, and if there, you could show me that. Okay. Well, I'm hoping that, you know, although this was probably not the easiest question on the exam, it does make sense that there's two steps to it. You know, one is asking what's the probability of 1.8, then using that probability we'll ask what's the chance you'd get a sample proportion of 0.25 or something bigger. Yeah? Okay. Okay, now we're on to interpreting some stata output, right? No calculations. Just interpretation. So on the next page, page 6, this is question 11, on the next page is shown the stata output for a test of the null hypothesis that population mean baseline CESD score does not differ by postpartum depression status, meaning yes or no. So, you know, right away we know this null hypothesis is that the mean in the postpartum group, I'll call it group 1, minus the mean in the non-postpartum depression group, group 2, that difference in means is equal to 0. Another way of stating that is that the means in both groups, both underlying populations, are equal. And it's asking that if you're intent on answering and looking at this null hypothesis versus an alternative that it is different with a two-sided significance level of 0.05, so we know our alternative hypothesis is that mu 1 minus mu 2 is not equal to 0. What would we conclude? So I'm going to actually not pay any attention to the responses. I think it's better not to. I think it's better to go and look at the output and make your own conclusion and then go back and look at the responses. So we can see that the first thing is, in order to test a difference in means, we first want to ask, does it look like the standard deviations in the population are similar or different? So should we eyeball them? 1.1 versus 1.2, but are the standard deviations. But we also see the means. These numbers are really quite low in magnitude, so the eyeball test is not necessarily going to help us. But we do see the variance ratio test result is giving us a p-value of 0.031. So our hypothesis was that the underlying variances were the same versus the alternative that they're different, meaning the ratio is not equal to 1. So with that p-value of 0.03, what would you conclude? I'd say it's unlikely that you would observe these standard deviations of this magnitude if the truth was that the ratio was equal to 1 in the population. So reject the null hypothesis of equal variance. Are you all with me? And conclude unequal. So I will X through the middle panel, which is assuming equal variance, to go to the unequal variance output. Does that make sense to everybody? Ask a question if it doesn't. So we're saying, how likely is it that you'd see the standard deviations that you did if they truly were not different? And it's just saying you'd only see this 3 out of 100 times by chance alone. So it's unlikely. Reject the null. Conclude that you're dealing with unequal variances. So we're concluding from that top panel that based on our data, the underlying population variances are not equal. And now we'll go back to test the null hypothesis about means. So again, if you have a question, please ask it now. That's why we're here. Makes sense that this is a p-value less than 0.05 for the variance ratio test, so we're going to assume unequal variances when we go back to testing the null hypothesis that the difference in means is 0 versus an alternative that they're not equal to 0. So I'm going to look at that bottom panel. I know that the two-sided test is given in the middle, so the p-value is 0.87. I also know that the 95% confidence interval for the true difference in means is given in this line that says difference. So the difference in sample means is only 0.01. The confidence interval ranges from negative 0.11 points up to positive 0.13 points, overlapping zero. So my conclusion right away is I'm failing to reject the null hypothesis, and I'd conclude that based on our data, looks like we're sampling from populations that have the same mean CESD score.
Yep.
You could get the same conclusions. We have pretty large sample sizes here, so you know when we pool here, it's not appropriate because our data are suggesting we have different spreads in the underlying populations. So you know, although we have both of these panels, we really should go with the one where we're not pooling. But say you got confused, you would almost have been in luck because the results are the same. But this is what the data would show, pooling or unpooled. We wouldn't want to pool. But the bottom line was, the question was asking, is there a difference in mean CESD score at baseline between women who have postpartum depression and those who don't? And I think that the data are suggesting, both from the confidence interval and the hypothesis test, the p-value, that no statistically significant difference. So then we'll go back and look at the responses. So I'm seeing a lot of things that say statistically significantly greater in women with versus without, with versus without, with versus without, right? Significantly different. It's not significantly different. So the only appropriate response would be that mean CESD score does not differ significantly by postpartum depression status. All of the other ones are giving confidence intervals that are just basically based on one group. Okay, number 12. So now the investigators completed separate analyses to investigate the association between postpartum depression, yes, no, and the two, three-year follow-up outcomes. So if you remember way back in Table 1, they were either homeless. Remember back to Table 1? Do you want to look at them again? Table 1 is here. Three-year outcomes, homeless, and then the other one was at risk of homelessness. Those are the two outcomes that are then on the STATA output that are behind question 12. So question 12 said, look at the STATA output on the next page to test the null hypothesis that the proportion of homelessness at 3 years of follow-up does not differ significantly by postpartum depression. So we either can say that the two proportions are the same, or the difference between them is equal to zero. So in English, what are we saying? The chance of homelessness in women who had postpartum depression is the same as the chance of homelessness 3 years later for women who do not have postpartum depression. And we're asked to look at then this outcome, proportion of homelessness, and look at interpreting the two-sided p-value. So here's the output. So we have underlined these because one is called proportion of homeless. The other one looks almost the same, doesn't it? But it's the proportion at risk for homeless, meaning they have some characteristics that are going to make them at risk, but they're not necessarily homeless. The first outcome, these are homeless, the proportion who are homeless. So here's the z-test, the two-sample test of proportions. I think that what we can do is look at the p-value, which is really close to zero. We could look at the 95% confidence interval. for the true difference in proportion homeless between the two groups, and it does not overlap zero. So it looks like there is a statistically significant difference, but we're asked to interpret this p-value of zero. So basically, the two-sided p-value is two times the probability of getting a difference in observed sample statistics that is of the same magnitude. What was our difference in proportions? So one group it was 0.06, the other group it was 0.02. So the difference is 0.04. That's what's labeled here as difference. So it's a 4% difference in homeless between the two groups. So our p-value by definition is the probability of getting a difference of 0.04 or something bigger in either direction, which we've translated into two times the probability of Z being greater than, here's our Z statistic of what, 4.63? So greater than that or something bigger in either direction. And we see that that zero that's listed here on the bottom of the middle column is that probability. So it's saying that our chance of observing a 4% difference in the percent or proportion homeless between the two groups or something bigger in either direction for all practical purposes is zero. So if we go back and look at some responses, in number 12, the interpretation of the p-value says the probability of observing a difference in means of 4% or some more extreme value, something bigger, is approximately zero if the alternative hypothesis of a difference in proportion of homeless by postpartum depression status is true. So how do we calculate the p-value? It assumes that the null hypothesis is true. So I should have maybe overly emphasized that. What we're asking is, if the null hypothesis that there's no difference in proportions is true, we're asking how likely is it that you would observe 0.04 or something bigger, or just by the luck of the draw it would be negative 0.04 or something smaller. So that probability out there in the tails of the distribution is basically zero. So our p-value is calculated under the assumption that the null hypothesis is true, not the alternative. So A is false. Is it the probability that the null hypothesis is true? So it's not a probability that the null hypothesis is true. It's the probability of observing the data that you observed, right? Or something more extreme. We never can say this is the chance the null hypothesis is true or not. It's the probability of observing the sample statistic that we've observed. The next one says the probability of observing a difference in proportions of 0.04 or more extreme, that probability is approximately zero if or under the assumption of the null hypothesis of no difference in proportion homeless by postpartum depression. So that's what we just described. The p-value is the probability of observing that value of 0.04 or something more extreme in either direction under the assumption that the true difference is zero. That's our p-value. And then we say the probability that the null hypothesis is true. We're not talking about the probability that the hypothesis is true. The probability that the alternative hypothesis is true. No. The chance of a type 1 error is approximately zero. Well, we're in control of the type 1 error. We set alpha to be equal to something so that we can decide to either reject or not reject. So the p-value is not talking about the chance of a type 1 error. Okay, so that was to define the p-value from that output. And then 13 is referring to looking at the results of both hypothesis tests for both outcomes. So if we looked at this, we already had seen that we saw a very statistically significant result when we were looking at proportion of homeless. And the second outcome was proportion at risk of homeless. So let's look at the p-value there, 0.0022. So again, these are both highly statistically significant. Both confidence intervals do not overlap zero. So it looks like, if we look at the data, so here we wrote this in, that X referred to depression and Y was no depression. That was just to help you along there. But what we see is there's a higher proportion of homeless in the depression group, postpartum depression, than in the non-depression. We also look at proportion at risk for homeless. It's 0.14 in the postpartum depression group compared to 0.09 in the non-postpartum depression group. So with both outcomes, we're seeing a significantly higher proportion in the postpartum group than in the depressed group than in the non-depressed group. So if we go back to 13, let's go through each of them. Was maternal depression, meaning during the postpartum year, was it associated with a statistically significant increase in subsequent homelessness as well as a statistically significant reduction in risk of homelessness? That's false. Why is it false? Because it's associated with increase in both. The next one says maternal depression during the postpartum year was associated with a statistically significant increase in subsequent homelessness as well as a statistically significant increase in risk of homelessness. I think that looks true. C says maternal depression during the postpartum year was associated with a statistically significant reduction in the first outcome as well as a significant reduction in the last one. So that's both false. It would be correct if they both said increase. And then D, maternal depression during the postpartum year was associated with a statistically significant reduction in the first outcome as well as a significantly significant increase. So I don't really mean significantly significant. I mean statistically significant increase in risk of homelessness. So what's the problem here? First one was also an increase. And then the proportion with a prenatal diagnosis of mental illness is a statistically significant confounder in this investigation. What? So our outcome is we're looking at two outcomes, postpartum depression, yes versus no. So E is just a red flag. Okay, so now we're on to the last scenario, very last. I'll just pause for a second. Any other questions about anything in this previous scenario? Okay. Then we'll go on to questions 14 through 20. Concern investigation of C-reactive protein, CRP, a marker of inflammation, as a potential diagnostic of cardiovascular disease risk. Researchers recruit a sample, so N equals 61, middle-aged persons, randomly identified in a large general medical practice. Each study participant gives a blood sample from which CRP concentration is measured in milligrams per liter, and the researchers will use tertiles of CRP, so in other words, the 33rd and the 67th percentiles, to categorize into lowest, middle, and highest thirds of CRP values. So we're told in the sample the CRP measurements have a mean of 4.14, so I would call this X bar, and a standard deviation S of 4.76, these are milligrams per liter. So number 14 says, if the measurements were normally distributed. So this is sounding similar to another question because it's saying measurements. So when we think measurements, we think the random variable, the X. So if the measurements, meaning the CRP values, were normally distributed, what would those tertiles be? So the tertiles would give you 0.33 in the lower third, 0.33 in the middle third, and 0.33 in the upper third, or thereabouts, all for a total under the curve of 1. So the question is, what is X1, which demarks the 33rd percentile, and what is X2, which marks the 67th percentile, or 66.7th percentile? And so how would we find these? We'd find them by knowing that if we transformed this to a Z, we would be looking for where we have 0.33 in the lower tail and 0.33 in the upper tail, which means what's in the middle? 0.33 in the middle. So what are the corresponding Z values? I'll call them Z1 and Z2. So let's do at least one of them. So how do we get X1? So, or let's do the up. I love the right tails. Let's do the right tail to get the 67th percentile. So what would this value of X be that corresponds to the Z that gives us 0.33? So first we'd have to look in the Z table and ask what tabled Z value in the B column corresponds to 0.33 in the upper right tail. I should have inserted the Z table here, but I didn't. But if you have the Z table in the back of your exam, look under B column 0.33. I can pull up the Z table if you want me to. Do you want me to? Okay. So 0.33, what do we see as that Z value? Anybody? No. Okay, so 0.44. So that's what it is for the Z. So Z is going to be X. So I'm going to call this, you know, because I've labeled it as 2. So the 67th percentile had a Z value of 0.44. The corresponding X will be X minus mu over sigma. So if the Z is 0.44, we want to solve for X. And what do we know? All that we know is our best approximation based on the data. So the mean mu we'll estimate as 4.14. So I can write 0.44, the tabled Z, equals X minus 4.14 divided by my best estimate of sigma, which is S of 4.76. So now we can say X, and I'm going to just call it X2 because it's the upper tertile. X is going to be equal to 0.44 times 4.76 plus 4.14. So if I'm lucky, this is going to be the answer. 0.44 times 4.76. It's about 2.09, and I add 4.14. And I am getting an answer that's about 6.23. Okay. So that would say that 6.23, and I'll just use another color here. So 6.23 is the value of the 67th percentile. So it's looking to me like that's D. And then, but I can also figure out the 33rd percentile. How could I do that? So by symmetry, what's the middle of that distribution? 4.14. It's zero under the Z, but under the distribution of measures, the mean would be the same as the median, which is 4.14. So it looks to me that that's about, what, 2.09 units difference? So the mean of 4.14 and the 67th percentile of 6.23, that difference is about, you know, if we rounded it right now, we would just say it's about 2. So if I was to take 4.14 and subtract 2, I get about 2.1. I could have solved it with the Z table, but I know by symmetry that that will work as well. So I'm going to put my money on D. The 33rd percentile would be about 2.1. The 67th percentile is about 6.2.
So. I actually used the stem and leaf plot to check my work because there was a small enough sample size, and 61 divided by 3 is about 20. So to make sure that my D scores, or that the results I got lined up.
Right. So Sarah's point was that if you use the actual data, the empiric data, you may or may not actually get the same thing. Because what are we told in question 14? We're told to assume that they're normally distributed. And what do we know when we look at the data in the stem and leaf? It's really skewed to the right. So you may have been lucky in trying to get a double check like that, but because of the skewness, the answer to question 14 that assumes normal distribution wouldn't actually line up necessarily with what you see here. But you are asked to make that comparison in the next question, which is 15. So it says, based on the observed data. So Naira, going back to 14. Okay, this is good. I mean, I was asking for questions, so this is good. Okay, so I think I'm hearing that, I was using the information about assuming it was normal and given that we had a mean and a standard deviation. Sounds like some of you may have had some tricks for doing this. I'm happy to entertain tricks if we can figure out if they had a rationale. This one was really meant to say, if you really have thirds and you're assuming a normal distribution, you're going to have to do something with the mean, and the standard deviation estimates. But tell us how you did you go as well to the data? No. Oh, the question is, what do the tertiles mean?
Yeah.
Right, so when we talked about quartiles, which we used a lot because we loved quartiles in the box and whisker plots, now we actually are saying we're not going to have the median and the 75th percentile and the 25th percentile. Rather, we're going to have 100% of the observations split into these three equidistant groups of the lower 33rd. Then if I took you up to the 67th percentile, that would say 67% fall below that. And then if I go up to the total, 100% fall below that. Okay, right. So, right. Okay, so the question was, we happen to know that within plus or minus one standard deviation is about the middle 68%. Then we said within plus or minus two, it's about 95%. If you recall, we also said the middle 50%, we had that on some problems, the middle 50% was within plus or minus how many standard deviations? Do you recall? 0.675, right, about 0.675, 0.68. So here we're actually even less. It's not the middle 50%. It's the middle 33% would be contained within 0.4 plus or minus 0.4 standard deviations from the mean. So that's what that z-score of 0.44 refers to. We would say that the middle 33% is within the mean plus or minus 0.44 standard deviations. Whereas the middle 50% was within plus or minus 0.68 standard deviations. Yeah, no, it's three boxes. It's three boxes of 33% each. Good. Okay, so we'll move on to the next one, which is related, that says, based on sample percentiles, with no normal distribution assumption, which individuals should be grouped into the lowest tertile? So we're sort of going back to Sarah who counted. So counting is good when you're looking at the sample or the observed or the empirical percentiles. So here we said N was 61. Oops, oh no. So N was 61. So if you took a third of 61, what would you get? We can do that together. So it looks like it's the 20.3rd observation. It'll come back, don't worry. So there it is. Okay, so what's the 20.3rd observation? Oh my. And how can you get that 20.3rd observation? There's no other way than counting, right? You just count. So we're going to count. And so maybe a trick with counting would be that I know in the first, so this is how I would do it. I would say that I know that there's 2, 4, 6, it looks like 9 observations. So I know that probably the same is going to be true here. This is going to be up to 18. So my 20th is going to be about 1.5, is that right? So it's in there, so I'd say it looks like it's about 1.5. So that means that 33% are at 1.5 or less, and 67% are at 1.5 or greater. Okay, but that's based on the observed data, the sample data. Okay, here are these Q normal plots that are coming up. We'll show them soon. But it says this figure 1 on page 13 represents 5 choices of a Q normal plot for the data. So maybe one thing we can also remember is that a Q normal plot will give us a plot that shows the observed data versus what percentiles we'd expect under the normal. And if we had the line of equality here of Y equals X, that would say the 20th percentile for both was the same, the 30th, the 50th, et cetera, they'd all be the same. So one of them is the correct one, and it says which is the correct one. So we have the observed data there, which was very much skewed to the right. So I'm going to rule out some right away. Plot 3, what would that tell you? Everything's on the line agreement, which says that your data would be normally distributed because you would see those quantiles match up. Then we see, let's look at plot 4. What do you notice about this? There's a parallel line, which would say, actually, your data, so the graph 3 would have said, if we superimpose these two, the observed and the normal, they'd be the same. Graph 4 said that actually we would just see that our distribution would be skewed, would be not skewed, but shifted to the right, but would follow a normal distribution. So it's not that one. Okay, now we're down to 3 other ones. I'm going to go to plot 2, because what's this showing? So it's not parallel, right? Here's the line of agreement. It's the solid line. What are we seeing in plot 2? Not only does it differ in mean, but it's completely differing in variance as well. So it's not going to be plot 2. So now we're down to 2 more, right? We're down to plot 1 or plot 5. And so what do we know about the distribution? Which direction was it skewed? Skewed to the right. What does that tell us about the distribution of the observed data? So it's positive skewed. We have observations that are out there in the right tail, meaning our higher percentiles are out in the right tail compared to the normal. So where are we going to see those observed? Remember, on the y-axis is observed, and the normal or is the corresponding values for the percentiles under normal. So because we see that there are these points above the line of agreement, that's suggesting the skewness to the right. Whereas if we looked at plot 5, what do you notice? Those points are below the line of agreement, which would not be reflecting a distribution that's skewed to the right.
Yeah.
Sorry. That's good. So an observation, although it's a little bit smaller on the screen than on your page, is that if you look at the axes, they actually vary a little bit according to these, but there are no negative percentiles. So you see that in plot 5, it actually is going below 0, which, you know, is not possible. It's not possible. You see that the line of agreement has extended out to negative values, but the observed data, none of them. None of those quantiles can be negative. The observed quantiles have to be positive because all the measures were positive. Good point.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Right. So in terms of the question was number five, is this an example of being negatively skewed? So I think what we would expect to see is actually that there would be, you'd expect to see these percentiles that are under the line of agreement, but the what you see on the bottom, those percentiles are probably going to be above the line of agreement. So this is sort of this combination of things that don't match. So it's not a purely negatively skewed distribution, but yes, the right-hand side of this curve, I would say, would be reflective of a negatively skewed distribution. Okay, yeah. So the problem with number two is that if we had complete agreement with the normal distribution, it would be on this line, you know, y equals x, which is the solid line. What we're seeing here is that this is a straight line, but it is not parallel to the normal distribution, and we're not expecting it to be. But we're also seeing that every single quantile for the observed data is larger than it is for the normal distribution. So if we went back and thought about superimposing a normal distribution here, so let's think about where's the 50th percentile under the normal. The 50th percentile is, you know, out here, but the 50th percentile under the observed is much less than it would be under the normal. And so when you see this, you know, this straight line, but it's not parallel to the line of agreement, it's not allowing any percentile in the observed data to be less than what you would observe under the normal. Okay, so that was 16. We have just a few more to go. Some of these are definition questions, like 17, which says, the researchers wish to create a 95% confidence interval for the lower population tertile. So don't be thrown off by it saying lower population tertile, because that can be any statistic, right? We could have a mean or a percentage or any statistic by using bootstrapping. So before we would maybe even look at the questions, we'd say, what was that bootstrapping technique? So the bootstrapping was this computational technique that said, we're going to take the data, and then we're going to have repeated samples of the same size, but repeated samples with what? With replacement. So it's like having an infinite sample. We keep, if some some item is selected, it goes back in for selection. And once we do that and create the tertiles from all of these repeated samples, we would plot them in a histogram. And what's the confidence interval or the bootstrap interval? It's just the middle 95% of that histogram. Does that make sense to everybody? So we're just, it's a computational technique where we're literally just sampling and sampling and calculating tertile, sample tertiles, say 1,000 times, plotting the histogram and getting the middle 95% of those lower tertile values. So, A, find the lower 2.5 and upper 97.5 percentiles shown in the sample data. That's only one sample, so that's not a bootstrap. That would just say the middle 95% of the observations in the sample. The next one says the bootstrap 95% confidence interval takes the mean plus or minus 1.96 times S over the square root of N. That's just using normal theory, not the bootstrap. That's our typical definition of a 95% confidence interval, so that's false. C, obtain 1,000 random samples of size 61 from the original sample of 61 values. Calculate the lower tertile in each, and then find the lower 2.5 and the upper 97.5 percentiles of these 1,000 lower tertiles. So that's what I mentioned, the middle 95% of the lower tertiles. So this would be the definition of a bootstrap interval. Or is it? Wait a minute. Yeah, it is. Now, what's D? Obtain 61 random samples of size 1,000 from the sample of 61 CRP values and calculate the lower tertile in each. find the lower 2.5 and the upper 97.5 of these 61 lower tertiles. So this is mixing it up, right? The sample size was 61. We want to have many, many, like 1,000 or 10,000 samples of size 61, and then get the middle 95% of them. So that's why this is wrong. We would want 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 random samples of the same size, 61. And then what about the last one? Obtain 1,000 random samples of size 61 from the large general medical practice and calculate the lower tertile in each. Find the lower 2.5 and the upper 97.5 percentiles of these 1,000 lower tertiles. So that actually sounds like an awful lot of work to get 1,000 random samples from the large general medical practice. It's not a computational method. Bootstrapping is a computational method, and the answer was C. And then we have three last questions in which it's a variation on trying to take these CRP tertiles, but using them to define high risk and low risk cardiovascular disease categories, and to look now at studying systolic blood pressure in these categories. So a study was done in which there were randomly identified 20 high-risk patients. For each high-risk patient, a low-risk patient with the same age, the same sex, the same family history of CVD was identified. So what's in common between these? They have the same age, the same sex. So this is really forming pairs of low risk and high risk. We're told that D is the difference between the systolic blood pressure of the high risk and the low risk patient who share the same age, sex, and family history. So our notation is what we've used before. We're just going to use H and L for high and low, for the means, X bars, for the sample means, for the high and the low, and S's, the sample standard deviation, for the high and the low. SP will be pooled, as we've said before, and then we have D bar and SD representing the mean and the standard deviation of the observed D differences in the sample. So D was the difference between the low and high risk blood pressure for these pairs. So on 18, you're asked to interpret this, which says that suppose that systolic blood pressure truly differs. So the key word here was truly differs on average between high and low risk CVD patients of similar age, sex, and family history in the population of interest, but a correctly implemented, so it's saying we've done this correctly, but the hypothesis test fails to find a statistically significant difference. So our null hypothesis is no difference. Our alternative hypothesis is a difference. And we're told that systolic blood pressure truly differs on average. So what are we assuming is actually the truth? The alternative. But our hypothesis test fails to find a statistically significant difference. So we'll look back at the null hypothesis and say, where would we say we have a statistically significant difference? Out in the tails. So what we're told is that we actually have done a hypothesis test in which it falls in the fail to reject region. So looking now again at the alternative, if our test failed to identify a difference, then what kind of a mistake have we made? What's occurred? Right, so it's in here where we are in the fail to reject region, but under the assumption that the alternative is truly true, that we've made a type 2 error. So it's beta, the probability of a type 2 error, the mistake that we've made, because of the fact that we've said suppose or assume that systolic blood pressure truly differs between the two groups. So that has drawn our attention to this alternative that says there is a difference. So the answer here was meant to be a type 2 error, B, If we look through why these other ones are wrong, what would a type error, type one error have been? Right, so it would have been a different setup. It would have said our correctly implemented hypothesis test, you know, rejected the null hypothesis, said there was a difference when indeed there truly was not a difference. So that's why it's not type 1 error. A p-value, which is smaller than the alpha for the test. Well, when the p is smaller than our alpha, that is just our definition of what is statistically significant. It has nothing to do with whether this was a correct or an incorrect decision. So that is not it. A confidence interval, which excludes the true population difference. So this is not relating to what we saw, which was that our test failed to find a statistically significant difference, which means that our confidence interval, if this was the case, would have overlapped zero, but we wouldn't have known whether it was an error or not. So D would be ruled out. And then this says the test has correctly characterized the truth in the population. Not if we're assuming that it truly differs and we didn't find it. So that is why E would not be correct. Well, E would not be the 1 minus alpha. So 1 minus alpha would actually be in here under the assumption that the null was true. So in English, 1 minus alpha is the ability to correctly support the null, right, which means not reject the null when in fact there is no difference between the systolic blood pressures in the two groups, right? So we can make two mistakes. Our mistake is in the tails of the null hypothesis is to say there's a difference when there truly isn't. That's alpha. The other mistake is to say there's no difference when there really is. That's beta. What are the correct things? The correct things are 1 minus alpha, which is the probability of saying there's no difference when there's no difference. And the other is 1 minus beta, which is statistical power, which is saying there's a difference when there truly is a difference, right? So we have alpha and beta as errors, 1 minus alpha and 1 minus beta as correct probabilities. Probabilities of correct decisions, shall we say. Okay, that was 18. Two more. Lots of formulas on this page, but 19 says, based on the study design. So we say, well, what was the study design? The study design took a high-risk person and paired them with a low-risk person. Which of the following provides the most appropriate critical region by which to test the null hypothesis that on average systolic blood pressure does not differ between high and low risk persons of similar age, sex, and family history? So the true null hypothesis that we're interested in is that the mean difference between low and high risk in terms of systolic blood pressure is zero versus an alternative that the mean difference is not equal to zero. Would you agree with me? So it's based on the study design. We do have two different groups, but they were purposefully paired with each other. So I'm going to rule out then anything that looks like it's a two-group comparison because we're accounting for the relationship. So I'd rule out A, I'd rule out B, I'd rule out E, because of the fact that it looks like I'm using two separate estimates of variance. So what are we left with? We're left with C and D. But the difference is that one of them is looking at the difference in means in the numerator. The other one is looking at the mean difference. Algebraically, what do we know is true? Algebraically, the difference in the two means, x bar h and x bar l, is the same as d bar. The numerator is the same. What's different? the denominator. So the question is, are we actually taking the information from the two separate groups and pooling the data, or are we actually accounting for the correlation of the low and high risk person and getting an estimate of the variance of the difference? And that's what we're doing. So the answer here was D, because it's a paired test. Now, what if you wanted to look back at the formula sheet to help you with this? Might you do that? If we did that, what would we see? Let's see if we can find it. So, formula sheet had two samples, then it actually had the paired. So that was about four lines down. So what we're looking at is taking the standard deviation of the difference over the square root of n, which is the same as the square root of SD squared over n. Yeah, so the notion here with this setup, you know, before questions 18 to 20, was that actually, instead of having these two independent groups of high risk and low risk, we actually were pairing them. So it's not a pre and post per se, but it's a correlation of the low and the high risk persons who share the same characteristics of age, sex, and family history. So the other examples that we could think of is, you know, if we had twins, so since they're genetically the same, you'd have twin one and twin two. The other we can think of, especially for maybe long-term spouses, that the habits of, you know, spouse, the wife and the husband might be the same. So although it's not a pre and post on the same, if there's enough correlation or relatedness between those individuals, so the notion is of correlation or relatedness or dependence. And so in this case, the low and the high risk are really only so the only thing that we know that it seems to be different between them is where they fall in their CRP tertile. We're expecting that these other factors of age, sex, and family history are probably the most important things related to blood pressure, outside of their, you know, this thing that we're measuring, which is the CRP. So it's that notion of relatedness. Otherwise, if we could assume that the two groups were the same, were independent, so if they were completely independent, let's go back to 19, what we would have to do is say, well, if it was a two-group comparison, then A might be appropriate, because then you would have two independent groups. There was no notion in the study design that they matched them. Then you would have to say to pool or not to pool. That is the question, right? And then we could either have A or B as the response. But it was that the study design was purposefully making these pairs. And now we're finally at the last one. Thank you for hanging in there with me. So 20. Suppose that the study employs two technicians to measure participants' systolic blood pressure. Technician A is known to produce systolic blood pressure measurements that are systematically too high, and technician B is producing systolic blood pressures that are systematically too low by approximately equal amounts, though. So they're shifted. So which of the following strategies is best at minimizing bias? So you see that's underlining bias. Bias is the difference between the measurement and the truth in a statistic, to test the null hypothesis that on average systolic blood pressure does not differ between high and low risk patients of similar age, sex, and family history. So would you, let's start with E. Just for fun, we'll start with the last one. In statistical analysis, use the logarithm of systolic blood pressure measures rather than the original values. So what's a logarithm going to do? Logarithm just changes the form, so it might take it from a skewed distribution to a non skewed distribution? Is it going to do anything with bias? Nothing to do with bias. So E would not have anything to do with eliminating bias. Could you instruct each technician to collect 3 systolic blood pressure measurements for each person assigned to him and use the average of the 3 measurements as the person's systolic blood pressure for the statistical analysis? That has something to do with something, but not bias. It has everything to do with variability. So you're still going to have biased measures. You're just going to get more accurate biased measures because you'll take an average. So it's not dealing with bias. What happens if you assign the high-risk persons to technician B and the low-risk persons to technician A? You're going to increase the bias, right? Even more. And if you assigned vice versa, high risk to technician A and low risk to technician B, you'd also increase bias. So those don't look pretty any promising. How about A? Randomly assign 10 pairs, so high and low risk together, the pairs, to technician B and 10 pairs to technician A. And so if you do that random assignment of these 10 pairs, the hope is that you're actually going to wash out the bias, because they're biased high versus low in equal amounts. So the answer that was meant to be A. And I believe that that brings us to the end of our review. Okay, so I'm still here if you have a couple of questions. Otherwise, I will bid you a good evening and see you later.